Hi, welcome to Zing Talk, where Benzinga brings you the biggest names and brightest minds from Silicon Valley to New York City. Today, our guest is Jeff Gannon, a private investor and the proprietor of Gannon on Investing, a blog. Hi, Jeff. How are you doing?
Good.
Good to hear. Thank you for coming on and talking to us today. I have a number of questions that we're hoping to talk about, and I'm sure that you can give us a lot of great information. The first one is, can you give us some background on how you got interested in investing, your investment style, your blog, and any other relevant information about you?
Okay. I started investing pretty young. I was 14. I started out just, I didn't know what value investing was, but I started out focused on balance sheets and past earnings, things like that. So a couple years after I started investing, my dad gave me an article about Ben Graham. And that got me into reading Security Analysis and The Intelligent Investor. So I became a real value investor after that. And then only 5 or 6 years ago, I started writing about investing on my blog, Gannon on Investing.
Great. Can you tell our listeners about some investment ideas, some current investment ideas that you find compelling?
Sure. The biggest idea I like is Barnes & Noble. Ticker BKS. A lot of people are short that stock, but I'm on the other side. A good buy and hold microcap is Berner Dental Management Services, and the ticker's BDMS. And they run dentist offices in Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona. A good net, Ben Graham liked to buy stocks below net current asset value, is Solatron Devices, ticker SODI. And a good like turnaround slash hostile takeover is Craftmade, ticker CRFT. They do they distribute what fans, lighting, and furniture.
Could you give us a little bit of brief background on Barnes & Noble? I know that Bill Ackman had a position in that company, and also isn't that the company that Yucaipa Group is currently involved in?
Sure. So I bought Barnes & Noble right after the board announced they were going to evaluate strategic alternatives. And that was during the proxy fight with Ron Burkle. The company is controlled by the founder, Len Riggio. He owns maybe 30 to 35% of the company. And in 2008, I guess, Ron Burkle started to buy stock in Barnes & Noble. And he kept buying until he got up to around 20%, where the board put in a poison pill to stop him. And so he was able to get another hedge fund. He doesn't acknowledge this, but this is the theory. He was able to get another hedge fund to buy up about 15 to 20% of the stock to help him out there. So about 70%.
But that was
Alethea.
That was Pershing Square?
No. Pershing Square actually was in and out of the stock. They're still in Borders, but actually they were in before Burkle. Burkle came after Ackman. So Ackman doesn't have any Barnes & Noble anymore.
Okay.
Yeah. So Burkle lost the proxy fight. That was like last month. And the company is up for sale. It's very heavily shorted. Only about 25% of the outstanding shares actually are freely traded. And so basically, like, all the float is short.
Wow. So that, I mean, that could be a tremendous catalyst on... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was going to say, the idea is just that you have a... I mean, it's basically, it's up for sale now. There'll be some people interested in buying it. Riggio winning the proxy fight, it makes that a little tougher because I'm not sure people believe Riggio will let go. But, you know, you have a situation where it's very heavily shorted. It's up for sale. And, you know, by the end of this year, we should know if there'll be any bidders.
Interesting situation, to be sure. This next question is a little bit different, but Warren Buffett has said that he is 85% Ben Graham and 15% Philip Fisher. you look at the kinds of businesses that Buffett invests in, however, an argument can be made that he's quite different from Graham. You have studied Benjamin Graham extensively, and I assume you are familiar with some of Buffett's investments. Can you talk about the differences between their styles and which one you prefer?
Sure. Buffett likes to buy an extraordinary company at an ordinary price, and Graham likes to buy an ordinary company at an extraordinary discount. So Graham kind of believes in mean reversion. He doesn't pay above average prices. He pays below average prices, and he kind of assumes companies in general will have kind of an average future. Ben Graham diversified a lot. He would own like 100 stocks at a time. Buffett would rather own like 5 or 10. Except for diversification, where I'm more like Buffett, I'm probably more like Graham. I probably tend more to trying to get a really low price rather than a really great business.
Another interesting thing is that Buffett clearly has taken a lot from Graham, but he certainly has tailored it to his own investment style, even though he himself doesn't necessarily admit that.
Yeah, I'd say over the years, Buffett has changed a lot. When he started his partnership and ran that through the 50s and 60s, he was very much like Ben Graham. Almost all the stocks he bought were the same kind of stocks Ben Graham would buy. One exception was American Express. But otherwise, he really bought the same things that Graham would have bought. And he worked for Graham, so that makes sense. But
right.
Starting in, I'd say, the 70s, he started to get interested in like advertising agencies, the Washington Post, some media, things like that. Started to buy a lot of things where the value was intangible. And I guess that a lot of that influence is from Charlie Munger, who's Berkshire's vice chairman.
Right.
Yeah, he got introduced to him around that time, maybe a little earlier, and I think that changed Buffett into thinking more about intangible assets, and that's like what led him down to eventually the Coca-Colas and Gillettes and things like that.
Do you think that he would be as successful as he has been if he hadn't altered his investment style a little bit? Would he be as successful if he would have, you know, just followed what he learned from Graham down to a T?
No, I don't think so. The problem, see, Graham never managed a huge amount of money. He tried to kind of maximize returns, and he would actually pay out most of capital gains every year in his fund. So he basically ran a hedge fund where he didn't keep the money from year to year. He paid it out to investors for the most part. Buffett has always retained all the assets. So like Berkshire, it's been 40 years or whatever now, it's never paid a dividend. So he's too big to invest in the Graham type things.
Exactly.
So yeah, so I'd say his performance in the 50s and 60s would have been the same if he had not changed. But starting in especially the 80s on, he just was too big to apply Graham's ideas. And also too many people were applying Graham's ideas. So it was getting hard to find the obvious kind of tangible asset bargains. And so he had to go into media and advertising agencies and things like Coca-Cola.
That last point's a good segue into my next question. An argument can be made the markets are much more efficient than they were when Graham was active and during Buffett's early years, which makes value investing more difficult. Do you believe this is true?
Yes. I'd say the stock market is a lot more efficient. Graham started in 1914, just before World War I, and the firm he started working for, the brokerage firm, didn't have any analysts. There were no stock analysts, and that wasn't unusual. So Graham actually was the first person in that firm to analyze stocks. Bond investment was serious then, but there's really no stock analysis that we're used to now. So because Graham kind of invented that way of thinking about things, and there were some other people who felt the same way Graham did, it changed from thinking of stocks as completely speculative to people thinking about it as investments and really studying it. And so you had a lot of brain power start to be applied to this kind of company analysis, kind of serious fundamental analysis that Graham did. And then in addition to that, you've got cultural change. You know, when Graham started, very few Americans owned any stocks. Now you've got a lot of people going to Wall Street, working there, focusing on these problems and figuring things out. And then last is just the last 20 years plus, you've had this huge change with computers. So it's real easy to screen for the kind of things that Graham liked.
Having said that, and we'll get into this a little bit deeper later on, but do you still believe that even in the large cap space that, you know, that there's enough inefficiency to be consistently profitable and make better than market returns through a value investing approach?
Yes, I think you can do analysis even on large caps that gets the kind of returns that justify active management. But I think the difficulty there is that a stock price is kind of set at the point where people disagree about a stock, you know, because you need a buyer and a seller to come together at a price, and they each have different ideas. And so in large cap stocks, what you get a lot is everybody's paying attention to the stock. So like Barnes & Noble isn't a huge stock, but that's a good example. The reason why the price is where it is because you've got all these people shorting the stock. So I'm actively taking a different view of the stock than they are. They really hate it, and I'm saying that that's a little too much in Barnes & Noble, that things aren't quite as bad as people think. But in a small cap stock, the difference is that you don't necessarily have as many people paying attention, and so a lot of times it's not that people hate the stock. They just don't know much about it, and they don't kind of necessarily – you don't have as much – I would say you don't have as much there's not the contempt for these stocks. It's just that people don't know about it, whereas in large caps, it's almost always in large caps you have to buy what's out of favor. You have to buy the industry at the bottom or whatever in large caps. You don't necessarily have to do that in micro caps.
That leads into my next question. Could you talk about the advantages of using a value investing approach in the small and micro cap space? And are the inefficiencies pronounced enough to offset the heightened risk? How significant are some of the inefficiencies in your opinion?
I would say the advantages in using a value approach is that a lot of people, even people who are more investment-oriented, not real speculative in their big-cap selections, think of small caps, micro caps as real gambles, and they don't take the idea of, you know, buying a good company or the margin of safety as being that important. So you just don't have as many people applying kind of value ideas outside of, you know, your blue-chip stocks in micro caps. I'd say the inefficiencies are huge. Like the stocks I mentioned, Solatron Devices, net current assets are close to $3.60 a share. I think the stock trades at $2.40. So that's like a 50% difference. Berner Dental, I'd say if that was a big cap, it would be trading in $25 to $30 range, and it trades for maybe $17. So there are really big differences. A good example is Craftmade, where there's actually a hostile bidder who's been trying to buy them around $8, $7.58, somewhere in that range. And the stock's probably $5.30. I'd say in big caps that's not going to happen. Enough people are paying attention to that. Enough people are kind of betting on the idea that something will happen there. So I'd say they're pretty big. You do get 30 to 50% discounts sometimes in microcaps if you're willing to look for them.
And, I mean, don't you feel, though, that in order to make it worth your while, those inefficiencies, they have to be that big because, I mean, there is some, you know, there are larger risks in for some of these smaller companies than, say, you know, a McDonald's or a Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I'd say they're two different things. You have to be compensated for the risk, and you have to be compensated for the work. Most of what I do involves a lot of work in kind of finding these companies in the first place. There's also risk in other microcaps that I try not to buy, which tend to be more young companies. Like, the companies I'm mentioning are usually not that young. And they usually they're not real promotional companies. They didn't really need to go public to raise capital. They probably, it's more of an accident that they're still public. So I'd say you have two situations. One is that a lot of microcaps are just young companies, haven't been turning a profit for very long. That's obviously risky. And then the other group you have is just they're really not well known, and they're not liquid. So you also have the situation where you can't get in and out of the stock very quickly.
Right. Could you give our listeners a general blueprint for what you're looking for when you're allocating capital using a value approach in the small to micro cap space?
Sure. So the biggest thing I'm looking for, well, I guess the first thing I'm looking for is a real obvious bargain. So something has to jump out at me. But the things I look for are like a long history of free cash flow. So I don't really look at earnings. I look at free cash flow. And I look back at least 10 years, usually more like 15 years. You can get all this on Edgar, which does SEC reports. And I also, like Graham, am looking for current assets, so like cash receivables mostly. You know, inventory is not ideal, but that works too. And I'm looking for a good balance sheet. Most of the things I mentioned have good balance sheets. KraftMaid doesn't, but most of the others have very strong balance sheets. Not a lot of debt. And usually they're usually in a niche. I look for stocks that kind of, they aren't a small fish in a big pond. I look for ones that maybe they don't have many competitors, or it's a really, really small segment of the market that they focus on, because I figure that if they've been consistently profitable in this little area for a long time, that means they're likely to continue that going forward.
In your experience, how long does it take, you know, for some, I mean, how long can some of these companies remain undervalued? So, I mean, what kind of time horizon do you have in order to apply this approach?
I think if you kind of look at what the return, the total return would be, and then you divide it as if, to figure the annualized return, you look at, say, 3 to 5 years waiting for it. 3 years is pretty common, I'd say. It doesn't normally take that long. I look at kind of a worst-case scenario of 10 years. And I figure if I can't get at least what I think the market will do for 10 years, if this takes 10 years to get to its intrinsic value, I should get, you know, at least 8% or 10% or something like that. So I try to avoid situations where I think, you know, maybe it's a, I think it's 30% less. I think the stock price is 30% less than intrinsic value, but it might take a long time to get there. So I either look for half off, or maybe in some cases like Berner Dental, they buy back and pay out dividends. So they don't retain any of that cash. So if they were doing that, then it would be different because you're getting paid every year. But for someone retaining cash, you know, it can take 5 years, sure.
Okay. When you're evaluating some of these stocks, how do you discount the inherent risks? Some of the things that just kind of came to my mind were a lot of these companies have less access to capital, less diversified revenue streams, larger competitors, and maybe less than blue chip management. I think you spoke a little bit on this in the previous question, but if you could just elaborate, that'd be great.
Sure. So basically, I focus on like a really big margin of safety, which is what Ben Graham would do. So if I think a stock's worth $15, I really try to buy it for $7.50, and there's no way I'm paying more than $10 for it. You know, I'm not going to pay less than $2 for every $3 I think it's worth. So it is a big margin of safety. I'd say the other thing is I try to look for a lot of consistency in the past record. I don't really do much work in looking forward about things that will change because I find I'm not very good at that. I'm not very good at predicting the future. I just look for kind of an overwhelmingly strong past record and then a big discount. So my margin of safety is really this, like, hopefully 50% discount from what I think the stock's worth. So if I'm wrong, I usually don't lose money. I just end up, losing some of that 50% that I was wrong by. I don't actually lose any of the money I put in. I just don't get the profits I was looking for.
Right. So maybe another way of understanding this is that in the small but micro cap space, if you have the time and the ability to identify the huge inefficiencies, that offsets, you know, the larger risk that you're taking dealing with, you know, a company that's maybe has a $50 million market cap or a $30 million market cap. Is that a way of understanding it?
Yeah, you look for a really big discount, and you also have to figure you're going to be stuck in the stock for a long time. I'd say probably maybe 1 out of 5 stocks I've been in each year has been bought out by some private buyer or something. So you don't just look to the market. You don't figure that other investors will be buying from you. You try to buy at a value that's less than what you think, like a competitor or you know, that any sort of buyout would happen at. That's the other way to kind of get your margin of safety.
Okay. Do you consider macro risk on the premise that smaller companies will be more adversely impacted by negative changes in the economy, credit markets, and changes in long-term stock market sentiment?
You know, macro risks are real. I'd say the biggest risk is the possibility of, like, a multiple contraction of, you know,
right.
P/E ratios all around going down. But that's a pretty big risk even with real big caps. Like, if you look back 10 years, Microsoft, J&J, General Electric, Coca-Cola. A big reason why their 10-year performance isn't phenomenal isn't so much that the businesses haven't done well, but that they start with such a high P/E ratio and now they're so much lower. But the way to avoid that, the only way I can think of to avoid that is, like I said, focusing on what a private buyer would be willing to pay. And the easiest way to do that is to look at the balance sheet and to insist on, like, a discount to net current assets, because then if the stock's selling for less than it could liquidate for, then it really doesn't matter what happens to the overall market in terms of what people are willing to pay for earnings. So when you can, if you can buy at a discount to the assets on the balance sheet, then you can kind of get around the problem of market sentiment. But if you're paying for earnings,
that's
really a problem with big or small companies, that a change in what the market's willing to pay for earnings is going to hurt you.
Okay, great. I asked you this before, or at least a derivation on this question. Can enterprising small-cap value investors generate better returns than those who focus on the mid- to large-cap space over a long period of time?
I'd say yes, but the key word is the enterprising. To the extent that you do work and you have some sort of skill in analysis and in picking stocks, to the extent that you're a stock picker, it will kind of amplify your returns, being in microcaps instead of large caps. But if you're a mediocre investor, it's not going to help at all to go into microcaps. The key is really that the work that you do, you can find these will get you more of a return in microcaps.
Right.
So if you're right in big caps, usually your return is going to be less. If you're right in microcaps, it's usually going to be bigger. But in terms of if you're wrong, you're not going to do any better in microcaps. It just amplifies whatever skill you've been able to develop. It doesn't really give you better returns if you don't have some stock picking ability.
That certainly makes sense. That's kind of the answer that I figured that you would give us. Here's our signature question, Jeff. What was the worst investment decision you've ever made, and what was the best investment decision you've ever made?
The worst investment decision I ever made was probably buying Vaxgen, ticker VXGN. I bought around 50 cents. It now trades under 30 cents. This was it had more than 50 cents in cash when I bought it, but I thought it would liquidate. They talked about liquidating, and they didn't. And that was probably the worst, because they didn't liquidate, and then they tried to merge into another company for less than their cash on the balance sheet. So that was a real disaster. I probably lost at least 25% on that, and I would have lost more if I hadn't sold out when I did. And I really only sold out because it looked like management was going to definitely try to merge into something for less than the cash they had. So that was a real disaster, just because I thought I had bought something that for less than the cash on the books, and it turned out really badly.
Right.
The best investment was probably Village Supermarket, VLGEA. I bought it late 90s, maybe 2000. It's a grocery store. It runs ShopRite in New Jersey. And that was probably my best investment decision, not because of the annual return, which is like 20 to 25%, but because you could buy and hold it. So So for 10 to 15 years now, it's been doing 20 to 25%. And that's really just an example of it. Maybe the PE on it at the time was 5 or something like that. I think price to sales was 0.1 and price to book was probably like 0.5. And so it was just really undervalued on all those measures. And what happened is it did well, but it's not a growth company. Like maybe sales grew 4 or 5% a year, if that, in those 10 years. But the market totally changed its valuation and now probably thinks it's worth 15 or 20 PE when before it thought it was 5. And so that's really where most of the return comes from.
Terrific. All right, Jeff, well, I want to thank you for coming on and talking to us. It's been very informative, very educational, and some of the ideas that you have about the small and microcap space are very compelling. So thank you, and I encourage all of our listeners, if you want to find out more about Jeff and his thought process in investing in the small and microcap space, please visit GannonOnInvesting.com. So thank you once again, Jeff, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Be sure to subscribe in iTunes. You can find a link to do that right off of the Benzinga homepage. The music that you're listening to is Beethoven Virus by Banya and is available on the Internet Archive. All Benzinga podcasts are released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.5 license, and all other rights are reserved.